From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. It's Friday, time for our reporter roundtable. This is when we get you updated on the news that made headlines this last week, and there is a lot to get to. So today, our panel includes Clark Corbin with Idaho Capital Sun, Nicole Blanchard, the Idaho Statesman's outdoors reporter, Sydney Kidd, reporter with Boise Dev, and Logan Finney with Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday, Gemma.
Happy Friday.
So let's start with the legislature. And Clark, I've heard it has been a day already, but it looks like lawmakers won't hit their March 22nd goal to adjourn the session. So why is that?
Yeah, Gemma, you're exactly right. It's been a day and it's already feeling like a full session, believe me.
But oh,
yeah, it looks like we have at least three more weeks to go. As you said, the original goal to adjourn the session was March 22nd. Legislators aren't going to make that. During a breakfast with reporters yesterday, legislative leaders said it's looking like March 29th for wrapping up the session. And the reason is because for the first half of the legislative session, there were a bunch of fights going on behind the scenes, particularly in the Idaho House, fights over the budget committee rules and votes. There was also a leadership shakeup where the Idaho Republican Party and the Idaho House removed former House Majority Leader Megan Blanksma and replaced her with new House Majority Leader Jason Monks. And so yesterday at breakfast, Republican and Democratic legislative leaders said that probably cost the legislature a week to 10 days. And so we're not going to be hitting that March 22nd deadline. Still, some of the biggest budgets in the state have yet to be considered, and there's still outstanding issues regarding transportation, regarding the Idaho launch grants that Governor Brad Little has put forward and made a big part of his initiative the last 2 years. So, and also, you know, more than 50 bills backed up that are still waiting for votes on the reading calendar. So a lot to get done. And I don't even think it's for sure that they'll finish up on March 29th. I think we still need to know yet if that's a realistic goal based on some of these budgets and other bills that need to be addressed, Gemma.
So I want to get into the meat of what's been going on at the Capitol this last week. And I know, Logan and Clark, you both have been covering this. But Logan, let's start with some citizen testimony that happened earlier this week. This was before a Senate committee about some state funding for school buildings. Can you talk to us about this?
Certainly. So this is House Bill 521. Listeners may remember back at the beginning of January, Governor Brad Little gave his State of the State address where he specifically called out the state of Idaho's school buildings. Specifically, ProPublica, the Idaho Statesman, have done some super great reporting in the last year over just how bad of shape some of the buildings in Idaho are. And largely that's because it is so difficult at the local level to pass a bond measure on the ballot on election day and borrow a bunch of money to build a new school. So this has been an ongoing conversation in Idaho for a long time, and it was Governor Little's big pitch for the legislative session, and this bill is apparently the bill to do it. So House Bill 521, kind of the long story short, is the state would take out a bond. They would go into the market, sell a bond to a financial institution, and then distribute roughly $1 billion out to all the school districts across the state. And that is expected to take care of their building needs over the next 10 years.
Okay, so Logan, explain this part to me, if you would. There is a bill currently out there that would promote a tax cut that has that would potentially maybe undermine I don't know if it's what you were just stating with the school building funding, but
Gemma, you're getting right into it because this is the weird, quirky part. School facility bill I'm talking about is the same bill as this tax cut bill. House Bill 521, it's nearly 30 pages long, and there is a lot of stuff in it. There is this bond for the schools. There are separate funds for the money to be gone into. It kind of rejiggers the way that the lottery money currently goes out to schools. It also would do an income tax cut, and it would change some of the kind of procedures and policies at the State Board of Education. And so the citizen testimony earlier this week that you referenced, this was in the Senate Local Government and Tax Committee. They had this bill up. And the citizens who came and testified were like, okay, it's super cool that the legislature is finally giving some money to schools. This would be the first time that I'm aware of that the state is actually directly giving money to local districts to take care of their building needs. The citizen testifiers said, that's cool. That's really exciting. But why does it have to be a second priority to this tax cut that's the main element of the bill? The bill is really being promoted as an income tax cut and property tax relief. That property tax relief being taking some of the burden off of locals paying for school buildings.
Okay, that is so confusing to me in so many ways. Because
you're
my
not the
understanding,
only one.
Okay, because Logan, my understanding is that right in the Idaho Constitution, it mandates that our state provide a uniform public school system. So is it fair to say it's almost like, it almost feels like they're trying to, you know, hey, here's this tax cut bill, which we know everyone will be happy about, and we'll just cram in this other stuff in 30 pages that maybe people won't pay attention to?
I don't know that it's so much that people won't pay attention to, but
okay,
but I do think you are getting it kind of a trend that has emerged over the last couple years in the Idaho legislature. The Constitution does stipulate that a bill has to embrace a single subject and clearly lay out what that subject is. So in theory, you're not allowed to do what Washington, D.C. does and just cram a whole bunch of stuff into a couple hundred pages that nobody has read. But talking to some of the lawmakers, they say the state courts have actually shown some pretty decent deference to the legislature in past cases, past case law where this has come up before the Idaho Supreme Court. Apparently, as long as the lawmakers are clear about what's in it and they are able to justify kind of to themselves as a group, as the legislature, that they are addressing a single subject. Who was saying this? It was Senator Jeff Schroeder from Mountain Home, who's an attorney. He said he's read through the case law and he's pretty confident that this specific bill would not get challenged or struck down, let's say, by a single subject rule. Also yesterday at the legislative leadership breakfast that Clark mentioned, minority leader in the House, Ilana Rubel, she pointed out school districts are desperate for this money. And so it would take someone actually filing a lawsuit to try and challenge the bill on single subject grounds. And she was skeptical that anyone would be even willing to do that if it would mean losing out on all the school money that's contained in the bill.
So, Logan, where is the bill right now?
So it made it through the Senate State Affairs, it made it through the Senate Government and Taxation Committee. So that means the bill is on the Senate floor right now. It passed through the House earlier in the session. So it is awaiting a vote in the Senate, and that's the last place it will be before it makes it to Governor Little's desk. And of course, this was a big pitch from Governor Little before it made it into lawmakers' hands. So I would not expect him to veto something that was largely his idea.
Right. I would agree. Yeah, I would agree with that. So, Clark, I want to turn to last weekend for a minute. We had the Republican caucus here in Idaho. Fill us in on what happened, because was it you wrote something saying what we had upwards of 93% of registered Republicans not voting. So was it just not a good turnout overall?
Yeah, turnout, Jimma, thanks. Turnout was really, really low. I reached out to the Idaho Republican Party trying to get their official turnout, and they haven't released it yet, but I calculated it myself based on the number of ballots that they said were voted on Saturday's Idaho Republican Presidential Caucus, which Idaho Republican Party Chairwoman Dorothy Moon said Donald Trump won. But anyways, I counted turnout at about 6.8% based on the number of registered Republican voters in the state of Idaho, which the Idaho Secretary of State's office provides that number, and then the number of votes that were cast in Saturday's Republican caucus. So real, real low turnout, about 6.8%. Now, interestingly, Gemma, even though Idaho has been one of the fastest growing states in the country over the last 10 years, there are actually fewer Idaho Republican voters who voted in Saturday's caucus than voted in the 2012 Republican caucus. And so this isn't a huge surprise. Members of the Idaho Republican Party and political scientists leading up to the caucus had predicted that turnout was going to be real low for this caucus because of a couple of reasons. But one, it was an in-person only caucus. There was no exception for absentee voting or for early voting, even when we talk about members of the military or religious missionaries, people who were ill or had a disability or weren't able to travel to their caucus site. It was only an in-person caucus. And so that's one of the reasons that we knew that turnout was going to be low. The other was, this is fairly new. This was a result of a problem that came up in the Idaho legislature last year that we've talked about several times, where the Idaho legislature unintentionally eliminated the presidential primary election that had been taking place in May. And then the Idaho legislature did not fix the problem, did not reinstate the presidential primary election. And so that's why we have these caucuses. The Republican caucus was Saturday, as you mentioned, and the Democratic Party has its caucus coming up later in May. We know that caucus has a turnout lower than a primary election, but just to compare it to a recent primary election, like I said, there was 6.8% turnout for Saturday's caucus. If you compare that to the 2020 presidential primary election in Idaho, that was 26% turnout. So quite a much larger turnout when we talk about a primary election versus a caucus with its in-person attendance requirements, Jemma.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit more about not just the caucus, but it was Super Tuesday this week as well. And Clark and Logan, I know both of you have been following this as well. Logan, let's start with you, because you sat down recently with a political analyst to go over the results. But can you also talk to us about what he talked about in regards to really how much influence Idaho actually has in a presidential nomination process?
Yeah, absolutely. I spoke with Josh Putnam. He's a political scientist. He runs a website called Frontloading HQ, and he really, really focuses on the presidential nominating process. So this primary caucus thing we've been talking about is a process where the parties decide who their nominees are going to be. And part of the reason that the Idaho presidential primary, when they were trying to move the dates around, the reason it got kind of struck out of the code entirely is because there's all these details. If for example, you know, RFK Jr. won the Democratic primary here in Idaho, but President Joe Biden ended up being the party's nominee, you have to have rules that say whoever the party ends up nominating is the person on the ballot. And so those were kind of the details that didn't get put back into code last year. What this ends up being is, after all of the states are doing their primaries and caucuses and whatnot, kind of like with the Electoral College, you're not actually voting for a person to be the candidate. You're voting for who your state party is going to be sending to their national convention. So even though people were going to the Idaho Republican caucus and checking a box that said Donald Trump, really what they're doing is voting for the Donald Trump delegates from Idaho to be the ones going to that convention. The Republican convention is going to be in Milwaukee this summer. So I talked to Mr. Putnam about these things. You can listen to that full conversation on the Idaho Reports podcast, wherever you listen to podcasts. And we talked about just the fact that Idaho is kind of a small state compared to others. In terms of the delegates to this Republican convention, Idaho has 32 delegates, and that's out of over 2,000 delegates total. So we're kind of aware that we're a bit of a drop in the bucket as far as the U.S. population goes. It's just hard to get presidential candidates out here.
Yeah, it really is, honestly, but just exactly for the reasons why you said. So stepping aside from politics for a moment, Nicole, Thomas Creech, who is a death row inmate here in Idaho, was set to have been executed more than a week ago. I think it's fair to say the execution was basically botched. First, can you start by telling us what we know about what happened?
Sure, Gemma. So Thomas Creech was scheduled to be executed on, I believe, the 28th of February. And after about an hour, prison officials said, we called this off. We weren't able to find a vein to place an IV line for lethal injection drugs. So as far as we know, they tried, I believe, 8 times to get an IV line established in different places, and none of those were successful.
Oh, okay. So after this happened, Nicole, which I think it's fair to say everyone was shocked by. I mean, I was actually out of town, but I was following this and was stunned when to find out that this did not happen. With that said, afterwards, Governor Little's office released a statement, basically saying that failed executions are common. Again, I was fairly stunned by that because I thought, well, I've never heard of something like this happening again. So, can you talk about just how common this is? Because maybe this is more common than some of us thought.
Sure. It's interesting because, this is the first time that this has happened in Idaho. So for all of us, this was definitely really shocking. And once we started kind of looking at similar issues, I don't know how common you'd say it is, just because, death penalty and executions are uncommon in and of themselves, but this is a situation that has happened in like recent memory, particularly in Alabama. It has happened several times in the last few years, with lethal injection, where the prisoner is, in the execution chamber, and the thing that does not go according to plan is just the placement of IV lines. And in some instances, they are able to eventually place an IV line, and they do successfully perform the execution. That obviously wasn't the case here, and Idaho Department of Correction Director Josh Tewalt was he really emphasized afterwards, we weren't going to continue to cause Thomas Creech any additional pain. We were trying to do this in the most respectful way possible and give him dignity, and so we weren't going to continue pursuing this when it became obvious that it wasn't working. But that's not always the case in other states. I know in Alabama they've spent several hours in the past trying to put an IV line on people. They've cut through their skin trying to get access to veins. And so I spoke with the former director of the Death Penalty Information Center, and he said, while this is a botched execution by definition, in that it didn't go the way that it was planned to go, he did commend the folks who were carrying out the execution for recognizing that the situation wasn't going according to plan and stepping back instead of trying to force this to happen.
Well, and Nicole, I mean, people can take sides either way when it comes
Sure.
to their thoughts and feelings on should there be humanity for someone on death row, right? I wonder about the people who were the ones having to try to find this vein, right? The
Sure.
all of that, like, so the trauma that everyone probably experienced. So I don't know if that has been something that has been talked about or not. But with that said, where do we know where this stands? Because the last I read was that a judge put a stay of execution back in place, and the Idaho Department of Correction has not challenged that. Has that changed at all?
It hasn't changed. So it sounds like the Department of Correction is kind of regrouping. There were potentially a couple factors with not being able to place the IV. One of those being that Thomas Creech is older. He could potentially have some health issues that make it difficult to access his veins. As you probably know, Idaho reinstated the firing squad as a death penalty possibility last year, but we don't yet have a facility built for that. So that's not something that they are able to look to as an option at the moment. So yes, that stay of execution was issued. So if the state does come up with a plan in the future, they're going to have to get a new ex death warrant or an execution warrant. And they're also going to have to procure some more lethal injection drugs, if that's the route that they take, and we've done some reporting on that. That's actually pretty difficult to find. They have to go to special compounding pharmacies. There are a lot of people who object to create those chemicals on principle, like you said, because of their feelings one way or the other on the death penalty. And so it's not going to be a very quick process.
Yeah, sounds like it. Okay, I really appreciate the update on all of this. Clark, let's head on back to the State House because, as we talked about in the first segment, still a lot going on. Tell us about a bill that would restrict who could actually request an absentee ballot.
Yeah, for sure, Gemma. We're talking about House Bill 667. But just right off the bat, what we have right now in Idaho is called no excuse absentee voting. And what that means is that any voter can request an absentee ballot and vote that way for any reason at all, even no reason. But if some people just prefer voting by absentee ballot, maybe they want to take a little bit more time and review their ballot in the comfort of their home. Whatever the reason may be. And absentee voting is popular in Idaho. I looked up numbers from the Secretary of State's office, and for example, just looking at the 2022 general election, almost 130,000 Idahoans voted by absentee ballot. That's about 22% of all ballots that were cast in the 2022 general election. So it's popular in Idaho. But what House Bill 667 would do would make several changes to who could request an absentee ballot, like you mentioned, Gemma. Now, if this bill passes into law, a voter would only be able to request an absentee ballot if they were unable to vote in person on election day or on all of the days that early voting was available. And they would only be able to request an absentee ballot if they anticipated being out of their jurisdiction or if they had an illness or another disability that would prevent them from voting in person on those days. On Wednesday, the committee actually sent this bill out for possible changes and possible amendments after several members of the public and both state and county elections officials came out against this bill. People were very concerned that this would eliminate the ability for many people to vote absentee ballot, that this would be a big change. And basically, they were saying that we haven't had problems with absentee voting in Idaho. It's popular. There haven't been documented instances of widespread fraud or abuse of the absentee ballot system. So it seems to be working. It seems to be popular. But between the public opposition and the opposition from several county clerks and from Idaho Secretary of State Phil McGrane, committee actually voted to send this bill out for possible changes. It's a little too early right now to say what those changes could be, or if this bill will re be revived and get back on track before the session ends, potentially at the end of this month. But Jim, the amending process is kind of an unpredictable process in the Idaho legislature, and it's a little bit tricky to follow because once a bill is sent out for amendments, any legislator can propose any amendment for any reason. And so we're kind of hopefully at a late stage of the session, and definitely going to keep an eye on this one. Because it would affect voting and elections. But the thing to know right now is that the bill has been sent out for changes that blocked it from going to the floor of the Idaho House for a vote. And I know that the legislative reporters will keep an eye on that one and continue to report on whether there will be any changes to the absentee voting process or not, Gemma.
Yeah, that could have big ramifications. Thanks for that update, Clark.
Well,
Sydney, before we head into a break, some big road projects on the horizon in the Treasure Valley, but tell us about one in particular. This is the 5 mile I-84 overpass.
The 5 mile and I-84 overpass is one of the last standing original overpasses that were built in 1966. And talks about replacing this have been happening since about 2018. In 2022, ACHD announced that it was working towards actually replacing it. And it is currently on a list of priority projects that Boise is submitting to ACHD. And I don't know if you've ever been out to the 5 mile overpass, but it is pretty small. And what's interesting about it is that there really isn't any infrastructure on either side for pedestrians or cyclists. So It gets about, let's see, it gets about 26,000 cars and trucks going over it a day, but
Wow.
about less than 20 people on foot or on bikes. So it's quite the difference. And while there is obviously a lot more people that drive to and from places than bike and walk, it's still, it's a very stark contrast. So they're looking at fixing this. They recently just completed the Cloverdale overpass within the past couple of years and added a raised bike lane on there. But when I spoke to ACHD, they said that the design for 5 Mile would be more similar to what they have in store for the Linder Road overpass that they're working on. And that would be just having a multi-use pathway on the side of the overpass. So pretty exciting stuff.
Well, and you have a picture of it up on Boise Dev. If people want to see, there is a rendering in this article on boisedev.com, so you can go to it. But I'm looking at it right now, Sydney. And I mean, what is nice about this, if they do the 5 mile overpass similar to Linder, as you said, I mean, it does give necessary access, right? I mean, going back to, well, only 20 people a day bicycle or walk, it's because it's dangerous. I mean, there's nowhere for a bicycle or a pedestrian to walk, and if you don't have access to a vehicle, I mean, that really limits people's capacity to get around. So as you were reporting on this, I am assuming that is part of the reasoning, right? Is that they've done studies on the need to really have this more connected to the rest of the city.
Yeah, absolutely. And when they discussed this in a Boise City Council work session, they actually did highlight the concerns for pedestrians and for cyclists on the road. They said it's very dangerous. And I was driving over there the other day, and I actually was watching somebody like try to walk across the overpass, and it made me nervous.
Oh.
I was like, "Oh, you don't want to be here." Yeah, definitely some needed infrastructure on there, and the renderings of the Linder overpass on that article are, they do show quite the difference in having that infrastructure provided versus the photo of the 5 mile overpass as it currently is, and there's just nothing there.
So my understanding, Cindy, is that so the Linder Road overpass, that is scheduled to wrap up one in the next couple of years, and then but the 5 mile project, we're still looking out what about 4 years before this would happen. So even though it's on the priority list, it's not like this is going to happen tomorrow.
Yeah, so right now it's in the design process, and that should wrap up within the year. And then it is scheduled to be constructed in 2028. The Linder Road overpass, I believe, is 2026 through 2027.
Okay. Well, as always, construction everywhere in the Treasure Valley, right?
Yes, and I did also confirm with ACHD that if something were to happen where the Linder overpass got delayed, that it would not impact the timing of the 5 mile overpass.
Okay, good to know. So let's all go back almost 4 years ago, March 31st, 2020. Now you might be wondering, okay, why should I be thinking about that? That was the day that we experienced a fairly significant earthquake in Boise. And should I mention, it was also the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. I can guarantee you that everybody remembers where they were. I was out on a walk with my husband in our neighborhood. We had left our then sixth and second grader at home because we were close. We had a phone. We're walking, and then all of a sudden, people start running out of their houses and they're yelling and they're like, "Did you feel that? Did you feel that?" And we're like, "What?" And they said, "There's been an earthquake. There's been an earthquake." And all I thought was, "Oh no, I have a second grader with anxiety. I have got to get home." And then my phone rang. And it was my second grader crying and my sixth grader being like, "There was an earthquake and the lights are shaking all over the house." Okay, with that all said, that whole setup, Nicole, There is some new research out that is really, shall I say, shaking up what we knew about that earthquake. So do you remember where you were? Okay, do you remember where you were? Okay.
I was sitting on my couch and I thought it was a garbage truck going by. And then I was like, that's taking a really long time to drive past.
And I think we all thought it was the apocalypse, right? Because it was the start of the pandemic, I swear. Okay, so what do we know about this now?
So initially, researchers thought, okay, this came from the Stanley area. That's where these aftershocks are coming from. We know that there is a fault up in that area called the Sawtooth Fault that was discovered in 2010. So we're thinking it was probably that fault. Unfortunately, we didn't have any equipment in that area to measure earthquakes. So we were relying on information from some stations that are pretty far away. Some Boise State researchers were able to get out there pretty quickly, but you know, it was March, it's up in the mountains, they were going through snow. So we had some information on these aftershocks, but not so much on this initial big quake. So now we've got folks with the Idaho Geological Society, the United States Geological Society, Idaho State University, Boise State University, all kinds of folks researching this area. They were able to go up and dig some trenches in the area of the Sawtooth Fault to try and figure out where this thing is coming from, like what is going on with this fault, when it has ruptured, all kinds of high level you know, geology and seismology stuff that's way over my head. But I spoke with Glenn Thackray, who's one of those researchers. He actually discovered the Sawtooth Fault. And he was one of a handful of researchers who published something in the Seismic Record, which is a journal, earlier this year. And they figured out that this big earthquake had nothing to do with the Sawtooth Fault, which is, it kind of turns everything that we thought we knew about it on its head.
Okay. So where do they think it came from then?
So that's the interesting part. They start poking around in this area and they realize, okay, there's some really ancient faults here. There are some newer ones. Some things that we thought were a single fault are actually split into multiple pieces, and they believe that it is tied to a fault that they identified for the first time during this research. It doesn't really have a name, but if you're familiar with the Cape Horn or the Banner Summit area that's along Idaho 21, it's kind of that Avalanche Alley area that gets closed a lot in the winter. It is a little bit north of there. And so they think that that is the fault that that gave us all a bit of a jostle a couple of years ago.
Huh. So what do they know then anything more, Nicole, in regards to then how earthquake prone our area is, because there was an earthquake last week?
Yes. Perfect timing, right? So
right.
That one is unrelated to these faults. That one came from kind of the Smith's Ferry area. If we're talking roadways, it's Idaho 55 on the way up towards McCall. My colleague Sean Goodwin spoke with the head of the Idaho Geological Survey, which is Claudio Berti, I think is how you say his last name. And he said, you know, we've known that faults are in that area. But it is kind of interesting that it's happening right around when this research comes out. I spoke with Glenn Thackray about this research in the Sawtooth Fault, and he said that one thing he really likes to say about studying earthquakes is we only know what we know. So now they've counted out the Sawtooth Fault, and you know, it raises more questions. It kind of gets rid of what we thought was maybe an answer, but now we know a little bit more, and we can start kind of pinpointing things. We know that Idaho is one of the more seismically active states in the country. I mean, everybody thinks California, maybe Washington, Oregon, Alaska, but we're up there in the top 10. So I think that's become something that we're all a little bit more aware of in recent years. But yeah, definitely it'll be interesting to see what we learn as we start getting more more research and more interest in figuring out, you know, what we have going on underneath us here.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, Clark, before I ask you your next question, where were you on March 31st, 2020?
Yeah, I was in my house and I thought that my roof was collapsing over my patio and I had no idea what was going on for about 10 seconds. And then, oh yeah, we're having an earthquake. So I definitely remember it. That was an interesting report though. I appreciate that, both of you.
Yeah. Okay. So, Clark, let's get back to the State House again, because I would like to know more, and I'm sure a lot of folks would, about a bill that's advancing in the State House. This would add monthly reporting requirements, but it would also change deadlines for ballot initiatives. Clark, this seems that there was always something going on with trying to change our ballot initiative process here.
Yeah. And Jim, that's a good point. That's exactly what several members of the public who came out to testify in opposition to this bill the other day had pointed out. But let's back up for just a second and talk about mm-hmm. what a ballot initiative is in case folks aren't familiar. But like a referendum, a ballot initiative is a form of direct democracy in Idaho. And that's where the people of Idaho can propose a law, put it on the ballot, and vote on whether to pass it or not, completely independent of the Idaho legislature. This is actually a right that's part of the Idaho Constitution, Gemma. And in 2021, the Idaho Supreme Court ruled that ballot initiatives and referendums are, quote, fundamental rights reserved to the people of Idaho, to which mm-hmm. strict scrutiny applies. And so the Supreme Court has taken a dim view in recent years over efforts by the Idaho legislature to limit or to restrict the use of ballot initiatives. This bill, like you mentioned, House Bill 652, it's kind of the latest effort that would make changes to the initiative process. Like you said, this would add a new monthly reporting requirement where supporters of a ballot initiative would have to turn in their signatures to the county clerk for verification every month instead of the existing single deadline of May 1st that is in state law. So that's one of the big changes. Another big change, if this bill is passed into law, is it would create a two-month public review period, kind of at the end of the signature gathering process, where the public would be able to remove their name from the list of signatures gathered for a ballot initiative if they change their mind or whatever. And that was another aspect of this bill that members of the public were concerned about, because signing a ballot initiative petition is just about getting that to qualify to appear on the ballot and go in front of voters. It has nothing to do with actually passing this. It's just about making an attempt to qualify it for the ballot. One other change, this would move up the deadline for the last day to gather signatures. It would move it from April 30th up to March 31st, so it would be a month earlier. This bill is advancing on a party line vote. Republicans supported it. The Democrats in committee opposed it. And so it's heading to the House floor for a vote. But there was opposition from some members of the public who came out and testified. We heard from Kendall Shaber, who represents the League of Women Voters of Idaho.
Mm-hmm.
This is another attempt and an ongoing effort to deny Idahoans their constitutionally protected role in bringing public matters before the voters of Idaho. Some Democrats on the committee, it was noteworthy, felt that there could be other complications from moving around these deadlines, that could really put the squeeze on other deadlines that the Secretary of State's office has for printing voter pamphlets and preparing absentee ballots to be sent to members of the military who are serving overseas. And so folks are saying that making all these changes might be a little bit more complicated than it's been initially presented. But Republicans did support that one. They said it's, in their mind, it's about transparency. They said as legislators, they have to disclose their campaign finance contributions every month. And so they felt that it was a fair standard, using their words, to have a similar reporting requirement monthly for the ballot initiative. I'm told that this would not affect the open primary ballot initiative that is in the works right now that folks are gathering signatures for, trying to qualify for this November's ballot. I'm told because that's already in the process, this new bill, even if it passes, would not affect the open primary ballot initiative, but would affect future ballot initiatives. Like I said earlier at the program, we're kind of getting late in the session, so we'll keep an eye on this one, but it could be coming to the House floor for a vote anytime there, Gemma.
And very quickly, Clark, as we wrap up today, as you mentioned at the very beginning, they had that March 22nd date, but now they're saying March 29th, but nothing is set in stone. So you're going to still be at the State House.
I'll still be there. Yep, non-binding. There's no requirement to adjourn by a certain date. So I'll be here till the very end. And I know all the other hardworking legislative reporters will be as well. So we'll continue to keep tabs on everything and report on all the news coming out of the Idaho State Capitol in downtown Boise.
Well, as always, we so appreciate all of the work that all of our area journalists do, in particular to our panelists today. Thank you to Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun, Nicole Blanchard with the Idaho Statesman, Sydney Kidd with BoiseDev.com, and Logan Finney with Idaho Public Television. Of course, everybody has websites. You can look them up, read their articles and their reporting. We are very lucky to have the journalists that we do. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.